The next case is 1-877, Dufferin County Council versus Stephen Ray Carto.
May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, I'm John Coghlan on behalf of Relator, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The board found that this respondent violated numerous provisions of the Code of Judicial Conduct and the Code of Professional Responsibility based on his misconduct occurring on 5 separate occasions. The board recommended a 12-month suspension with 6 months stayed. Relator has filed objections indicating that we feel the appropriate sanction should be 24-month suspension with 12-month stayed. These are not just erroneous legal decisions. As the board found, the respondent used the tools of his office not for the intended purpose of impartially deciding cases, but rather for other and often personal reasons. The first two counts deal with the contempt hearing for Mr. John Snodgrass, who was the Director of Human Services for the Department of Harrison County. Mr. Snodgrass's motion, the respondent's motion for show cause was filed against Mr. Snodgrass based on an allegation that Mr. Snodgrass had failed to comply with a court order concerning placement of a juvenile. The respondent commenced that contempt hearing before the time to comply with the court order had expired. He personally subpoenaed 13 witnesses to that hearing, including the 3 county commissioners, virtually the entire staff of the Department of Human Services, including secretaries, when it appears that only one of those members of the Office of the Department of Human Services had any direct information about whether Mr. Snodgrass might have violated the court order. On the very first day of the contempt hearing, when Mr. Snodgrass, the subject of the contempt hearing, is not even present, the respondent spends 20 minutes to a half hour lecturing and haranguing the department, not on the issue of the contempt. He doesn't address them about whether there was a violation of his court order. This is a buildup of issues that have been going on between his office and the department. Before the time for the order to comply with the order expires, which was April 22nd, close of business on April 22nd, 1994, respondent returned the juvenile to her parents, which removed custody from the department, in effect preventing them from ever being able to comply with his order. So there could not have been a violation of the order because he removed custody from them before they had a chance to comply at the end of the time period. Nonetheless, he continued the contempt proceeding. He prosecutes it, he presides as the judge, and he appears as a witness. And finally, he finds Mr. Snodgrass guilty of criminal contempt, but refuses to impose a sentence. Despite 3 written requests that he do so, to this day he has never filed a sentencing.
If you never impose a sentence, how would you ever be able to appeal such a matter and clear the record and challenge the finding?
Well, that very fact is one of the issues that we raised as an aggravating fact and part of the misconduct. Mr. Snodgrass made a big point in his testimony that he did wish to appeal and have a review of this matter. And the respondent, at the time that he finds the Mr. Snodgrass guilty of contempt, specifically says, this is not subject to appeal because there has not been a sentencing yet. So he precludes that by virtue of his actions.
is that proper conduct for a judge to deliberately prohibit a person from appealing the decision by failing to complete it?
Absolutely not. We submit that is part of the misconduct engaged in by the respondent here. He is obligated under the rules of the superintendents of the courts to sentence. He's obligated under the code to comply, to follow through and complete actions pending before him. He violated the canons in that regard. In count four, the Patricia Smith contempt matter, he orders her into court and files no charges nor makes any formal journal entries whatsoever concerning the matter. He fails to inform her of her right to counsel. He provides her no opportunity to cross-examine any witnesses against her, and the only witness is a non-sworn bailiff who works for him. He threatens her with indefinite incarceration. And he says, I could put you in jail longer than Mr. Morrell is going to be there. Mr. Morrell was her boyfriend, the probationer who had been sentenced to 3 years the day before. He also says to her, under civil contempt, I can leave you there, which is a totally improper statement of the law to her, but it has the effect of threatening her, and I submit scaring her severely as she testified. He also tells her, if there are any problems of any sort, any kind, any sort whatsoever, I'll do an arrest warrant and you'll do at least 30 days and we'll probably find something else to add at that point. All in a situation where contempt was not the appropriate response to what he claimed he saw her do out of the corner of his eye outside the courthouse after court business was closed. In count five, we have two particular matters brought forth. The Doug Grimm juvenile matter, where in July of 1998, he sentenced the juvenile Doug Grimm to 90 days incarceration when there was no statutory authority to do so. In the second part of count five, it's a matter concerning both brothers, Doug and Jonathan Grimm, a little bit later in the year, November of 98. His employee is the alleged victim of a threat by the boys. He instructs her to see the prosecutor. He then talks to the prosecutor and instructs the prosecutor to file felony charges so they could be placed in detention. And I quote, if we could get a felony charge on them, we could file for delinquency and put them in DYS. When the assistant prosecutor shows up for the detention hearing, he states to him, I'm glad to see we have felony charges on them. Even though these two juveniles specifically state during the detention hearing that they want a lawyer, that they have a lawyer, they even name him, Mr. James Stern, he proceeds with that detention hearing without providing them with access to their counsel. He finds the boys to be a flight risk. There was absolutely no evidence at the hearing that they were a flight risk. That is a prerequisite under Juvenile Rule 7 to placing them in detention on a pre-hearing basis, a pre-adjudication basis. He testified that he learned of the flight risk from a discussion with his probation officer, ex parte discussion, out of court discussion. As a result, both boys were placed in detention for 10 days, which is exactly, we submit, what he was trying to achieve before their next hearing. In the Andrew Akers matter, he got so upset that a juvenile was being moved from one foster home to another that he tells the county prosecutor over the phone, I want you to issue arrest warrants for three members of the Departments of Youth Services, the director and two other workers there who were involved in this move. And when asked about that, he tells the prosecutor for malicious contempt. And the prosecutor hadn't heard of that, I had never heard of that, but he uses that phrase to justify requesting arrest warrants. Fortunately, the prosecutor was able to talk him out of having those arrest warrants issued on that occasion. That night, however, he does issue an order requiring that the department move the child in the middle of the night from the second foster home back to the first foster home. This occurs at 2 in the morning in a foggy night in July of 98. Finally, after all this happens, he specifically tells the prosecutor to tell the Department of Social Workers, Human Services Director, Mr. Snodgrass, that caseworker who did that, moved the juvenile, violated my order, which I submit is not true, and if she does not resign, I will hold her in contempt. So he threatens contempt to get her to resign her position from the Department of Human Services. We have recommended the sanction we have in this matter because of the respondent's lack of candor, lack of remorse, and has failed to accept responsibility for these actions. Regarding the Snodgrass matter, he told my office, and he reaffirmed at the hearing, that what he wanted to do when he sent that motion for show cause over was to have a private discussion with Mr. Snodgrass and find a resolution and to find a placement for the juvenile.
Do you have any indication, is this a personality conflict or is this an employment problem? Or why would he do these things?
Well, there's indications that there was a long-standing series of disagreements between his office and members of his office and the Department of Youth Children and Family Services. So there were miscommunications going on, there were problems between the two offices, and I think that led to what this was basically the straw that broke the camel's back. However, it's an inappropriate use of his authority and power as a judge to single out the director for this contempt, drag in all the members of the office, and subject them to a lecture under subpoena. And that's what my concern is. That's improper use of his authority. He brings in the county commissioners. He's castigating the head of the department, accusing him of being on the golf course when the gentleman, he just learned that he's actually in a seminar in Columbus, in front of his bosses. And he has his bosses there, and I asked him, well, why did you have the county commissioners there? Well, they knew about the availability of foster homes.
Is there any indication, statutory or otherwise, that a common pleas judge in this county has jurisdiction over these activities of the county, vis-a-vis the county commissioners?
I'm not sure I understand which activities, Your Honor?
The supervision of this particular department of the county government.
I have absolutely no reason to believe that there's any authority that the judge has to supervise the Department of Human Services in that county or any other county. That department chief, the director there, is hired by the three county commissioners. That's who his employer is. He operates as an independent county agency. He hires and fires his own people. So no, he doesn't. They have to work together, but I don't think that the Common Pleas Court has any authority over them as an employer.
In the case that's the most egregious, or allegedly most egregious by you, was the child ever in any danger?
Which one are we talking about? The first two counts involving the contempt?
And the moving of the child.
Oh, the moving of the child. Arguably, driving that child across the county in a foggy night was a potentially dangerous thing. Nobody got hurt, and we're all very thankful for that. But I don't see any reason why the court had to require that movement back. That child got moved back to the house the judge ordered him out of by the judge's order within 2 days. So instead of one being placed in a house and being moved once, this child's placed in a house, moved once, moved back, and moved again 4 times.
At minimum, it would be very disruptive to the child, I would guess.
That was one of our contentions.
Bad at 2 a.m., I guess we assume that, but to be pulled back and forth, that's really difficult for a child at that age, I think. But
I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I might.
Let me just make one point. Ms. Smith, who was the person he brought in and without a record and said, I could hold you in contempt, I'm not going to, because he heard a noise that he thought endangered him.
Right.
She was not related. She was sort of outside this dispute he was having with the department, or the agency, I think, wasn't she?
That's completely separate and apart from his ongoing dispute with the Department of Human Services. Totally separate incident.
Is your concern that there seems to be a pattern of a judge using his power, if not his authority, using his power in ways that he's not authorized to use it, and that the appearance, at least of that, at a minimum, is that here is a judge who doesn't understand really what it means to live by rules and statutes and so forth. Is that the impression I guess from what the board found and your arguments?
I think that is part of it. There's definitely the appearance issue, but I think we also have a situation where his misuse of his authority has actually adversely affected numerous people. Mr. Snodgrass, the Director of Human Services, was publicly shown to have been in direct contempt, allegedly, never sentenced, never been able to challenge that, and we feel that was an erroneous judgment all around.
And that contempt order was a written order. That's a record, unlike the Ms. Smith.
Well, actually, he never journalized that, as I understand it. There is we have a transcript of the proceeding.
In which he finds him in
right,
contempt.
Correct. But according to our understanding of the law, it doesn't apply until there's actually a sentencing. There's no actual contempt until there's a sentencing. A juvenile gets sentenced to 90 days when he should not have done a day. That's definitely damaging to that juvenile, if not the public in general.
Did each of these individuals file these complaints? How did these complaints come about?
They came about through lots of different ways. There were different things that were brought to our attention, and when we went out... Well, grievances were filed. Grievances were filed, and we went out there and some of these individuals, some of these things were brought to our attention by other people. So some of these were grievances they filed.
Did you complain then? It was filed by your office?
That's correct. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Colvin. Judge Carto, first.
May it please the court, I would like to reserve 7 minutes. I am Judge Stephen Ray Carto. I have made errors in judgment. It was my error not to pronounce sentence on Mr. Snodgrass. It was my error to switch from a lecture to contempt with Patricia Smith. It was my error to use a repealed detention statute on traffic matters with Doug Grimm Jr. I deeply regret each error. Nevertheless, not one error on my part arose from an inappropriate motivation. I acted in good faith at all times. There has been no willful judicial misconduct on my part.
Let me start with, if I may, with the failure to give Mr. Snodgrass an opportunity to
certainly
appeal the finding of contempt. That's a pretty serious matter. For a judge to find a head of an agency in contempt of court and then not be given when there's a request made by his lawyers, I understand, that you sentence him so he can appeal. Well, is that just an oversight or?
Well, sir, what happened is this is a matter that occurred in 1994. I heard, as ODC has indicated, 3 letters from his counsel, and then I heard nothing for over 5 years. And to sentence Mr. Snodgrass, again, I admit, is procedurally wrong to not sentence him. I should have filed an entry. But I had reached a point where I felt enough was enough, that the court had proved its point that you must obey a court order. You can disagree with me personally all you want to, but when there's a valid court order, you must obey the court order. And I felt that I had made that point, enough was enough, I let it go, I had no other ulterior motive, and I simply went on to other things.
But when Mr. Snodgrass says, please sentence me, I guess I understand your view is that, as far as you are concerned, it's enough, I made my point, but here's a person who's been found in contempt of court and would like to have the opportunity to have an appellate court review that finding, and yet you hold his destiny by not letting him appeal. Isn't that more than just a mistake?
It well,
looks like there may be some animosity there that's being reflected in a judicial act.
Mr. Chief Justice, I believe that it's sort of a two-edged sword in that while he could not appeal, he neither had a contempt finding on his record of any sort. I believe that under the circumstances, the contempt finding was appropriate based on the evidence that we heard at hearing. But I also felt that there's no need to take this matter any further. There's no need for me to pronounce a sentence on Mr. Snodgrass. I felt that the court had made its point, and that's all farther that we needed to go. And I needn't provide him with any kind of a record. Now, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel accuses me of willful misconduct, bad faith, malicious intent, and improper purpose, and says the board so found. That's not true. The board did not so find because it didn't happen. The ODC has created a perception of me that is not reality. These cases do not accurately reflect the real Steve Carto. The board found in its decision on page 1 that I had an unblemished judicial record for 15 years. It's 17 years now. I've handled thousands of cases both as a county court judge and a common pleas judge without incident. The use of the court's inherent contempt power has been sparingly used. I care about people. I have a special affinity for children. Judges make tough decisions, not always popular decisions, and I'm willing to make those tough decisions. I became a judge because I wanted to help people and provide solutions. Anywhere I might have done any less, I deeply regret. But it's been my honor to be elected 4 times by the people of Harrison County. They know I respect the law, and they know that I provide fundamental fairness in my courtroom. Everybody knows everybody in Harrison County. It's a small county. I'm not an anonymous judge. In that environment, there is no need to go overboard on contempt. The exercise of maximum judicial restraint is the norm for me.
Counsel, Judge Carto, I'm concerned about the scenario where the allegations are and the panel so found that you acted as judge, juror, witness and prosecutor.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell me, was that a mistake or that was good faith? What was
in fact, it was done in good faith. I believe that...
That you took off your robe and then acted as a witness? Also acted as the judge?
Yes, ma'am. I did because I felt that I wanted to give Mr. Snodgrass an opportunity to present all the evidence that he could possibly present. His attorney first told me...
But I understand you subpoenaed the witnesses.
I subpoenaed witnesses because I did not know where Mr. Snodgrass was, and each of the witnesses that I subpoenaed I felt had something to add to the issue as to whether there in fact had been a contempt or not a contempt. I think as has been indicated by Mr. Coughlin, there were a lot of people telling stories that weren't true and so forth, and
today,
I needed to get to the bottom of it for the best interest of children. Yes, ma'am.
Today as we're having this hearing, it sounds like you thought that was an appropriate proceeding.
The contempt proceeding?
The calling the witnesses and judging the matter being a witness.
I would submit, ma'am, that this court has the same authority, an inherent authority to call witnesses, an inherent authority to prefer contempt charges against someone, and an inherent authority to prosecute is also provided by statute, and there is also a law that can be cited to you that indicates that a judge can testify as a witness, both as a witness on his or her own, or as a witness called by the other side. I agree with you that it does present an unusual sight, certainly, and
you
it presents an unusual... Yes, ma'am.
I have one other.
Sure.
Would it be at all appropriate in the mistakes that you... concede, would it be an appropriate assessment to say that at times you have used your office to intimidate people in your county?
No, ma'am. No, absolutely not. I know Mr. Snodgrass well, and I know I cannot intimidate Mr. Snodgrass. It certainly is not my intention to intimidate Mr. Snodgrass. My position.
Well, I'm even talking about the Grimm brothers.
Okay.
The brothers who were incarcerated.
Sure.
Because they were a problem to a staff member.
And I'll proceed to that right now, and with regard to Patricia Smith, I saw Patricia Smith. I saw her raise her hand to me. I saw her form her hand as if she were making a gun, and I heard her go like that to me. My bailiff heard that same unmistakable sound. She was shooting me. In light of serious death threats that I've had for doing my job as a judge, I for a split second was concerned for my safety.
I regret that the bailiff said he did not see a thing. He testified here that he didn't see anything.
The bailiff's testimony was that he did not see her hand action, but he heard the sound. So the board has mischaracterized his testimony, I believe. Now, I regret the way the proceeding was handled. I only wanted to impress Ms. Smith on the gravity of her conduct, taken in light of the fact that I had just sent her boyfriend to prison. I harbored no intent to harm her in any manner, but I regret the manner in which I handled the matter. I meant to admonish her, to lecture her. I did not mean to have a contempt case. In the middle of the matter, as I was lecturing her, trying to explain to her how serious what she did could have been, I did switch gears to a contempt case, and that was definitely my error, and I should have not done that. She did apologize 4 times for what she did and said what I'd done was my fault. I hold absolutely no ill will towards any member of the Grimm family, especially Doug and Jonathan. They're two boys that we worked with extensively in our juvenile programs. We utilized every avenue possible. Doug was before the court 9 different cases. He's currently in prison as an adult for a burglary. Jonathan, we had several times in court. I did not call the prosecutor and tell the prosecutor that I wanted him to file a felony charge. There was no phone call at all. Nevertheless, Juvenile Rule 9 provides for the screening of cases by the judge. The judge has the final authority as to what cases should be filed and should not be filed in the best interest of the public and in the best interest of the youth. I follow usual and customary procedures pursuant to Juvenile Rule 7, as are followed throughout the state in all other juvenile courts. The detention hearing was held prior to the youth's placement at Sargis Juvenile Detention Center. They were not even in detention. Before the first hearing, I gave them more procedural rights, safeguards, than required. DHS, who was the legal custodian of the boys at that time, was present. And at that point in time, there is no right to counsel, and the court may consider any evidence without regard to formal rules of evidence, Juvenile Rule 7. Further, under Juvenile Rule 27, juvenile court can be operated informally. This before the court was substantially a probation violation. Broad authority exists under the juvenile rules in probation violations. A detention hearing is the functional equivalent of an arraignment. Any statement made by juveniles without counsel are not admissible against them. I finally recused myself in that case, not because of any bias, but I just simply wished to avoid any possible appearance of impropriety. My only motivation with the Grimm boys was to help them change their lives. Now, Doug served some time on another probation violation, not the traffic offenses. But I did use an outdated statute in the traffic disposition. And for clarity of record, I'm sure you've already reviewed the record, when I said the new book was stolen, I was referring to the one I would have used to prepare for my disciplinary hearing in Akron, not the one that I used on the bench at that time. Finally, I would address the Andrew Akers matter. Andrew was a young man that I had special concern for because of his overall situation. He was depressed. He was virtually homeless, penniless. He was asking for help but had no hope. I promised him that he would stay for a few days at the Dunlap Therapeutic Foster Home. If that happened, he promised me he wouldn't run away or harm himself. The Dunlaps were foster parents for Guernsey County, a neighboring county, but lived in Harrison County. The court and Guernsey County DHS agreed that the placement would be 3 days, terminating at the end of Sunday. However, Kristen Davia of the Harrison County Department of Human Services removed Andrew from that placement in less than 24 hours. Without notice to the court, it was kept a secret from the court. Kristen Davia directly violated the court's order. The Office of Disciplinary Counsel's explanation of the facts is tortured. I never issued a contempt order or arrest order against anybody in this matter. I confided in Mr. Pushcarriage, seeking his guidance as my statutory attorney. He's the prosecuting attorney. I spoke only to Mr. Pushcarriage. The court had clear jurisdiction over Andrew's placement. I've heard the word malicious contempt used here previously. Malicious contempt is a term that I have never used in my life, nor have I ever heard until Mr. Pushcarriage used it. Andrew Akers was 16 years old. He was not a small child. The move took place much later in the evening than it should have, simply because Department of Human Services was on the phone for close to an hour and a half before they made the first move. It could have been completed within an hour, and it took them 3 to 3.5 hours to complete that move.
That the foster parents and the Guernsey County personnel needed to agree with and they did not agree. That's the relator's argument. I think that's the word.
If I understand your question, they did in fact agree with the court and were satisfied with the placement. The only way that things began to get kind of regulated on that was the Harrison County Department of Human Services started calling Guernsey County and started putting limits on things and so forth. Finally, Kristen Davey had also told a client that I was after her kids, and she violated further the statutory confidentiality identifying the person who complained about these people that she talked to. That was clearly a broken law by Kristen Davey. Mr. Pushcarriage, you'll see in the record, confirmed that in his testimony. I discussed this with the prosecutor, the need for action here. He chose to ask her boss for her resignation by letter. She refused, and nothing further transpired. I did what I did in the best interest of Andrew Akers, and for that reason solely. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Carto.
Yes.
Mr. Stern, do you wish to speak now or in rebuttal?
I will speak in rebuttal.
Okay. Mr. Coghlan, you saved a little over a minute of your time.
I truly wish I had a little more time to address some of the things you just heard, but let me start with the allegation that juveniles have no right to counsel at a detention hearing. Juvenile Rule 7 says they shall be advised of the right to counsel and the right to assigned counsel. How could they not have a right to counsel if they're supposed to be advised of their right to counsel? It was not a probation violation. Read the transcript I submit. It's clear there. He's the one who calls it a detention hearing. The whole purpose was to see whether or not they should be placed in detention. He proceeds to that. He makes that finding. He makes the conclusions without the requisite basis to do so.
Counsel, one of these, was the first count, 1994?
Yes, sir.
Why so old?
It was not reported to us before 1999. I can't explain why the individuals decided not to report that, but they chose not to earlier.
Was this one of the matters that came to you while you were investigating something else?
That's right. This came to light. Somebody mentioned, well, you should talk to Mr. Snodgrass. He did not bring this forward to us. We went to him because somebody said we should talk to him. So we went and asked him.
He didn't bring it to you?
No, he did not bring it to us. Neither he nor his counsel brought this to us.
At the time you were in on these other matters, did the working relationship seem to be professional? You're in there in 99. This is a 94 incident. Was that a speed bump in their relationship and the court and the director functioning in a professional and appropriate fashion?
It appears to be that was more of a speed bump. I have no direct information that they had and serious ongoing problems since then, but there were some disagreements. Clearly, the issue about Andrew Akers was a problem, and the director was very concerned.
I mean, these people have to work with
That's
each
correct.
Other on an ongoing daily basis, practically.
That's correct. And as you, I'm sure, are perfectly well aware, the prosecutor who testified here and provided significant testimony against the respondent appears every day before him. So they all have to keep trying to work together in a rather difficult situation. But I would just like to point out there's a number of things in the record that show that this respondent did not come forth and did not come clean. He just tried to explain away the stolen book, which was the first time we'd heard that explanation. But I think, since my time has run out, I just want to point out a couple of last things really quickly. We're dealing with a pattern of misconduct over a period of time. There's a lack of candor here, attempt to blame it on lost books, for example. A failure to acknowledge the wrongfulness. Now, we just heard, well, I made errors in judgment, but he's not said once that he's sorry for what happened to Mr. Snodgrass's reputation, for what happened to the juveniles who got incarcerated wrongly, to Patricia Smith being scared nearly to death. No express remorse for those actions or an appreciation of the improper nature of his conduct.
Now, you say that Mr. Snodgrass's reputation was damaged. Yet you previously said Mr. Snodgrass never came forward to you. He didn't file a 1994. He didn't file a grievance that his reputation was so damaged. He did nothing about that.
Well, what was damaged by, his reputation was damaged by virtue of the newspaper articles. And I don't know if there was anything he could do to change that, other than word of mouth in his own professional community, trying to explain to other directors what had happened. And he chose not to pursue an ethics complaint against the judge. And maybe that was partly a matter of, I need to try and make this relationship work in some fashion. It's only going to be aggravated if I proceed further. I don't know, but that's a speculation on my part. This is not a case about judicial independence. It's certainly not a case that challenges judicial independence. This is a case about a judge whose actions threaten the integrity of the judiciary by virtue of the appearance and his actions involving specific individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coghlan. Mr. Stern, you have about a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jeffrey Stern on behalf of Judge Cardo. A quick response to Justice Cook's question. In our brief, we indicated authority that a judge may fulfill multiple roles in a contempt, and one of our sources on that was Magistrate Judge Michael Merz, and this is the first major point that I would make this morning. I don't believe it's been made heretofore, but it's darned important. It was darned important in the case. We proffered the testimony of Judge Merz, who I think is generally recognized as a towering expert in this area, a highly qualified expert in this area, the testimony that he saw no exceeding of the contempt powers in the Snodgrass matter, no exceeding of the contempt powers in the Smith matter, and the proper pursuit of procedures by Judge Cardo in the Acres matter.
Let me just ask you that. I'm learning something here, because frequently when an affidavit disqualification is filed against a judge asking the Chief Justice to remove the judge, sometimes the argument is, the reason given is that this judge is going to need to testify in the case that's before the judge. That's always considered to be, if it's clear the judge is going to need to testify in the case before the judge recuses himself or herself. There's no question about that. Is that just good practice, or is that...
Well, it's in this case, Your Honor.
Merz, or Magistrate Merz would disagree, I guess, with that.
Sorry?
I guess Magistrate Merz would disagree with that a judge can testify in a case which would suggest the judge might have some interest in the outcome, not necessarily, and then decide the case. That's okay.
I believe that was the proffered testimony. He saw no exceeding of the contempt powers in this particular situation. Of course, Mr. Snodgrass' counsel requested Judge Cardo testify. In the brief, we point out the five undisputed mitigation circumstances. The record that is unblemished, total cooperation, language that is very strong, and that is really undisputed in this case. I do respectfully dispute the assertion of my colleague, Mr. Coghlan, that this case has nothing to do with judicial independence. I respectfully ask the court to re-review the last portion of their answer brief, in which the Office of Disciplinary Counsel takes the position, admittedly by them, a new position in the state of Ohio, that whether a judge's erroneous legal decisions may amount to misconduct. One of the standards there is a pattern of repeated legal error over a period of years. Another is bad faith. We respectfully suggest that those are nowhere near fulfilled in this situation, and I cannot imagine anything that would be more antithetical to the valued independence of the judiciary contained in the preamble of the Judicial Code explicitly than this attempt to engraft this new doctrine here. I appreciate the minute of time, and I thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise.